Nice. All right. Well, thanks so much for putting together that overview. It was super helpful and gave me everything I needed for sure.
Great.
So this conversation will be about an hour and a half-ish, max. And I
Okay.
kind of put together an interview guide based on what you sent over. And I want to start with, do you remember the first time that you did something entrepreneurial in your life?
Oh wow. So probably the first thing would have been like as a kid doing like the lemonade stand concept, but I think we had a I think it would have been a little neighborhood store we put together with my brother who was older and his friend, and we were selling, I can't remember what all we were selling, but the main thing, my brother made up some formula for a makeup that you, for a Halloween makeup that you could peel off after you were done. We thought it was the greatest thing ever, so we figured we had to sell it. So we put a lot of effort into like getting the store ready. We created this like mountain out of paper mache, set it up on the side of the road. I'm not sure we made any sales, but but that was probably the very first business venture I ever had. We had a name for it and everything, and we probably gave it a day or two to try to make it work, and then gave up on it. So that was probably it, and that was probably it for a while,
What was the
until I was
name?
an adult. The name was Mount Store, so it was a combination of our two last names for me and my brother and his friend. So our last name Turknet T, and his last name started with an M, so MT. So we called it Mount Store. We made a paper mache mountain.
Nice. I love it. I always love starting off that way because I find that almost everyone, at least that we interview, has one of those stories, you know, one of those early life stories where they tried the entrepreneurial thing early on. So I want to switch gears a little bit, and I'd love for you to tell me a story about the first time you ever played an instrument.
So boy, I think the first real memories I have are playing a keyboard. So my brother and I got a like a Casio keyboard from like Lechmere, which is an old store, department store back in the 80s. This is like when keyboards and synthesizers were first kind of hitting public market. And so we got really into the whole keyboard thing. Just, you know, you could mess around and just make sounds on your own and so forth. But eventually we started just kind of picking out stuff on our own. By ear. I'd kind of always wanted to play piano, but we didn't have a piano, so this was the next best thing I could have for a while. And so just messed around with that, and this is like elementary school. Messed around with that, just trying to pick out, you know, things from pop culture and songs that were on the radio and stuff like that. Axel F was big, right, big then, so that was a big keyboard hit. And a few other things, and that was the main extent of what I did musically for a while. Would just be doing that, and we upgraded to a nicer one for a little bit. It was just messing around with that. I think we even dabbled in MIDI back then, and that was really like out there at the time. But that was it for a while until I was in high school. We finally did get a piano, and I took a little bit of piano lessons during high school. But for the most part, I've dabbled in music, you know, from fairly early on, then got more serious about it the older I got. But always been more in the self-taught by ear domain than the sort of formal methodology.
Right. So, you know, you grew up and you decided to go to college and major in neuroscience and behavior. What made you decide to pick that kind of major?
So, I'd always been interested, or not always, I guess, but before college, had already had an interest in the brain and in neuroscience. I'd kind of thought I would do something along those lines or be an engineer. And sort of those are the two things I had in my head. Both of my parents are psychologists. So that's kind of where the behavior side comes in. We always had those discussions at home anyhow that probably primed me for an interest in behavior in some capacity. I did like a science project early on, eighth grade, that was kind of neuroscience-based, sort of talking the whole left brain, right brain thing, where I brought friends over and asked them different kinds of problems that I'd present to either their left ear or their right ear as a way of trying to distinguish between which side of the brain was better at which problems. But that kind of opened the door for me to the whole concept of neurobehavior, and so sort of the brain basis for cognition and behavior. So I think from then on, I kind of had an interest in it, would read books on it from time to time. And then part of the reason I went to the school that I did was because they had a neuroscience major. There weren't too many places that were offering that at the time. So I wanted to have that as an option, and that's what I ended up doing.
So once you got there, was it what you were hoping for as far as the material you were learning and kind of how it applied out there in the world?
Yeah. I mean, yes and no. You have always have an idea, about a thing that's not quite the same as the reality of it. But there's a lot of the sort of the nitty gritty biology that you have to kind of learn and have as a foundation before you can kind of get a grasp on some of the higher level stuff. But at that point, I was still kind of trying to decide, what I would eventually do if I would do something with this particular degree. And trying to decide whether or not I would, go to academic PhD route, research based, or go into the field of neurology or medicine in general. But I knew if I did that, I would probably go into the neurosciences there as well. I think I decided pretty early on that I thought at least that the clinical side of it would be a better fit because that's where I could do more of the neurobehavior stuff. If you're just doing neuroscience, it's hard to do the behavioral side of it. And that's still, we're still pretty much working with human beings when you're talking about the behavioral side of neuroscience. And so the best place to do that is in the clinic, working with patients.
Right. So was that your intent as you were graduating college? Did you want to go directly to work and see what it was like out there in the field?
I did. In retrospect, I might have not, in retrospect, I might have taken my time a little bit more. At the time I thought, this is just what I would do. I would get my degree. And then, I guess part of it too is that the path to becoming a physician is long enough. So you, at that age, you're seeing all these years ahead of you. You're like, I want to get these out of the way as soon as I can. So, that was kind of the plan. I didn't really think of any other route at that point in time. Once I kind of decided that would be where I would go, that I would, go into medical school. And I knew going into it that neurology would be the only field that would really appeal to me. So I was one of the unusual people in that regard that I went in with a pretty clear idea of where I was going to go after medical school. Mm.
So did you jump straight into medical school?
I did. Yeah. So straight from college to medical school. At Emory in Atlanta.
So what did that feel like to know that you would end up spending, kind of 10 years of what for many people is their working life towards getting that board certification eventually? What was, as you're looking down the barrel of that at the very beginning, how does that feel to you?
On the one hand, one aspect, it was motivating and I've kind of a goal-driven person, so kind of having that in my mind, you have this very clear path towards getting from one point and moving all the way down to the end, and it's all clearly set out. So from that standpoint, it's exciting. I didn't at that point. I think now, in retrospect, realize more like how much, you know, how many years and how much time and effort was expended going down that path. And I think if I were to put myself back in those shoes today, it would feel a lot more daunting. It would feel a lot more like a sacrifice. But I guess that's sort of the bliss of being a little bit younger and ignorant, right? and not knowing quite how much you're sacrificing at the time. But sometimes I don't like to think about how much time I spent, you know, studying for tests that ended up being useless and trivial in the end.
Yeah, I can imagine that would frustrate.
So, you know, you can't go back. So I try not to regret too many things. But you know, there is a lot of time and effort put into times when you are at your most productive and you have, you know, the most time on your hands to do things. So, it's a daunting task, but at the time, I was primarily motivated, and I think it tapped into my kind of achievement-driven, goal-driven attitudes at the time.
Right. So you went on and you got your board certification as a neurologist, and eventually you would write a book.
Yeah.
And it was called The Migraine, or My Migraine Miracle. How'd you go from, you know, kind of graduating medical school to writing that book? What was the path there?
So, long and winding probably, but it started really with, I got into the whole ancestral health paleo sphere. I guess it was around 2009, 2010. And just more for my own, you know, I was actually just like randomly, you know, clicking links and, and happened upon that whole world. But as soon as I did, I was like, yeah, this makes, you know, complete sense. And I went, you know, headlong into it. And as part of that, decided, you know, I needed to kind of, I wanted to overhaul how I was eating and some other lifestyle stuff. In so doing, ended up pretty much eradicating my own migraine headaches. And, you know, I'm a neurologist. I have migraines. It's what I do. So it was a little bit ironic, right, that I'd inadvertently stumbled on something that would get rid of them for me.
Right.
So, you know, at first I was, you know, pretty excited about it and, you know, started sharing it with whoever I could, including my patients. But felt like, you know, this is certainly not mainstream. This is not something most people know about, but it has the potential to help a ton of people. So that was really the first, and I was like, so that was really the first, you know, impetus for deciding to write a book about it. It was just trying to find a way to get it into as many hands as I could, because I knew it was something that could help people. Plus, I also was wanting ways to incorporate sort of ancestral medicine as much as I could into my own practice, because I believed in it so much. And this was a vehicle that made sense for me to do that. So I wrote that book at that point in time, primarily, you know, just as a way of getting it out there. And sort of felt on some level morally obligated to put it out in the world and try to help people with what I'd learned.
And so at that time you were practicing medicine, yeah?
Yeah, still am.
As a independent or?
Yeah. So I have practice with one other, neurologist.
Okay. So, cool. Yeah, so you kind of have your own practice there. So what did writing that book kind of teach you about yourself and just about, I almost look at it as a side project, you know? Yeah, it's integrated with the business, but it's also its own thing.
Right.
What did that teach you about yourself and just getting outside of the traditional, doctor sphere?
Yeah. I mean, it was certainly, I've definitely got me out of the traditional doctor sphere in some way. And I think, I mean, there are a lot of things probably that set in motion because of it. But one of the things, I mean, one of the frustrating things about the way our whole healthcare system is set up, is that it's a pretty inefficient model. And so it's not easy for me to connect, with people who I can help the most. Whereas in writing a book, it's a lot easier, right? They're, you know, people are selecting that. People who are selecting that book are a lot more likely to benefit from it than someone who just randomly walks into my office. So I think that probably set the wheels in motion in terms of, you know, thinking, is there a better way for me to be able to deliver, you know, what I have to offer, you know, in any sphere, but particularly in the world of healthcare? Are there ways that I could do that better than the system that I'm in right now? And so that has been something I've been thinking about ever since the book, and even more so lately, especially as I kind of understand the tools in the world of online business is even better. I continue to think about ways that I can deliver that on a bigger scale and in a more efficient manner, and find people that I can help more easily.
Right. So you're still a practicing neurologist, but you have this hobby on the side of
right.
banjo. So
right.
when was the first time you picked up a banjo?
First time I picked up a banjo, my brother and my parents bought it for me as a Christmas gift while I was an intern, my first year of internship as a resident. So that would have been December of 2000. So that was the first time I picked up a banjo. I'd been playing the guitar for about a year prior to that, and like I said, I'd been playing piano and keyboard as the first thing that I did. So, but yeah, December 2000 was the first time I picked up a banjo.
What do you think it is about musical instruments that attracts you to them? And then, like, in particular, what's attracted you so much to the banjo?
Ha ha. That's a good question. Well, I mean, I've always music has always appealed to me. I've always been big into music from, you know, an early age. So many people are, but it's kind of, you know, there's been a soundtrack to my life ever since I can remember, and I, you know, I'd enjoyed making music. I realized that was something I wanted to do from pretty early on. But I think that there's that aspect of it, just being a fan of music in general. But I also like learning music as well. I was real into sports growing up. As I got older, it became a little bit more difficult for that to be in my life, especially with getting married and then having, you know, working as a physician. Time for those things were a little bit less. Music was a way to kind of translate some of the same things that I liked about sports into something else that didn't quite have the same time commitment or time constraints. So what I mean by that is the whole process of mastery. It's kind of, if I look back, I've kind of been addicted to that for a long time. First with sports, but then with music. So I really like the process of getting better at something. I like the fact that music is such a high feedback environment. It really, it's a great way to sort of understand the learning process. And you know, when you're on the right path and when you're not. And then as far as the banjo, so there's probably a few reasons there why I'm such a fan. I probably first heard it through the Muppet movie with Kermit the Frog, which would have been like late 70s. That probably planted some little kernel there that would then blossom later on. So I like the fact that it's unconventional. I've never been particularly conventional myself, so that part appeals to me. So I like that it's not the guitar, like it's not the main thing that people do. I've always just been captivated by the sound of it. I like the fact that people oftentimes have a very sort of narrow preconception about what it is, usually much more to it. After people, you know, peel back the layers a little bit, they find there's a lot more to the banjo than they realize, both in terms of sort of its history, but also what it's capable of doing and expressing. And then I also like the fact that banjo players are seldom kind of the ones out in front of the band, right? They're usually the ones sort of playing a supportive role or kind of back, you know, they're not typically the front man. And I've always rather be behind the scenes than kind of the guy up in front. And I think that that's true of most banjo players, is they tend to be a kind of a humble bunch, don't really care about having the spotlight. Those are probably the main things that appeal to me about the banjo in particular.
That's awesome. As opposed to, let's just say, like electric guitar players.
Exactly.
But we won't go there. So tell me how'd you go from getting that first banjo as a Christmas present to kind of teaching yourself to actually enjoy it and be capable of enjoying it?
Yeah, so whenever I take on something, I tend to get pretty obsessed with it. So after a few months, I was into it pretty hard. But at the same time, I didn't have a lot of time. So this is still my internship, with working about 80 or 90 hours per week, at the hospital. So I could only practice during the gaps in the day. Even before this, sort of, I'd always been really interested in the learning process, and it kind of, just from a practical standpoint, had tried to figure out ways to make my learning process more efficient. And this was sort of a great way to test those ideas. So I basically in the time windows that I would have, would work on it and practice it, and mostly on my own, you know, using some online resources and so forth, where I needed to, but basically taught myself, you know, over the next several years how to play.
As you were kind of picking up the instrument and learning it alone, not in like a weird way, but just like alone, you know, you were practicing alone and
right,
learning it as you went. Was there ever a time where you just felt frustrated or wanted to give up on it, or was it a pretty natural kind of learning process?
There were certainly times in the beginning, when I felt that way. In fact, there may have been a time or two where I put it down in the very beginning and didn't come back to it for maybe a few weeks or so. It was actually listening to some banjo music, particular album, that kind of lit my fire again, and that was when I said, okay, I'm going to stick with this and figure it out. And I did, but it can be a difficult, there are different styles of playing, and the initial style I started playing is called Scruggs style or three finger style. That can be a difficult, one to pick up initially, because there's sort of a learning curve you have to go through before what you're doing sounds like music. Once I hit that point, then it was a lot easier.
Right. Do you remember the name of that album?
Yeah, it's called Foggy Mountain Banjo, and the song that was is called Home Sweet Home. So I heard that driving home from work, and I was like, I got to learn how to play that. So
that's awesome. No, I love that.
Yeah.
When did you first realize that your many years kind of building expertise as a neurologist might pair well with teaching people how to play banjo?
So, yeah, I felt like as I was learning the banjo that I kind of had, and the same thing with the guitar, that I had an unfair advantage in the sense that I could, there were things that I already knew sort of about how the brain worked. And how we learn and how you make changes in the brain that support any learning of any new skill. I had sort of those principles along with having kind of been obsessed with the whole idea of learning for a while anyhow. So I was able to kind of to use those things to my advantage and shortcut the process from what would the conventional idea of it would be. So, you know, I'd heard it should take, you know, so long to be able to learn how to play. And I was able to do things and or get to places and be able to play things in a shorter period of time than sort of what the conventional wisdom held. And what I realized was that, you know, how we go about learning is probably the most fundamental determinant of our success. But with the music materials that I had encountered, that was not really ever addressed. And so I realized that there was this kind of this gap in the market for, you know, somebody to come along and really you know, fill that in. And what I also found was that when I was learning, what I really wanted to know was, like, this, you know, if I take a player who was playing I admire, I want to know how he got there, you know. But what so often was presented in teaching materials was not that. It was almost kind of like, here's how you can sort of reverse engineer it and almost shortcut your way to playing how he plays. But actually, if you don't, you know, if you don't end up going down the same path or learning in the same manner, you're actually not going to get to that same level. You really need to go down the same learning path someone took to get to the level that they're at. But there was nothing out there that kind of showed that process. And so I felt like, you know, at some point it'd be great if I could do that, if I could take these principles that I'd kind of developed over the years, both kind of practically, but then also from a more theoretical standpoint after, you know, informed by what I knew about neuroscience and so forth, and take that and sort of bake it into a methodology that incorporates the how of learning, not just kind of what to learn.
Right.
So yeah, it was during that learning process, realizing that I was able to do things faster than what people said, and that I was successful at it. I mean, one of the great tragedies to me is that most people who take up a musical instrument end up failing. And most the time they conclude that it's just because, you know, they weren't cut out for it, or, you know, they weren't, you know, talented enough to do it. But, you know, I'd say 99% of the time that's not true. It's simply because they didn't have the right, you know, the right path to go along. And if you don't have that, it's really hard. It's almost, you know, dumb luck determining whether or not you make it or you don't.
Right. So where'd you get the idea to write the Your Brain on Banjo series and the banjo newsletter?
I started that around 2009 or so. So those ideas, like I said, were kind of filtering around in my head. Like, you know, I really wish this was out there in the world, right? I wish there was something out there that sort of showed people or took people down the path for how to learn something in the best way. And I decided that, you know, I would like to sort of crystallize my own ideas on the subject. And I figured a good way to do that would be to share it with other banjo players. So the Banjo Newsletter is kind of the magazine, the main magazine for people who are into the banjo. I you know, pitched the idea to the editor there. And it was really a way of forcing myself to get these ideas, you know, out there for my own, you know, selfish benefit, but also to try to get them out into other people's hands and just to see what the response was, to see, you know, if it's something that other people found to be of value. And it ended up being the case.
Did you find in writing the migraine book that also helped you solidify your thinking on the topic? Was that a trend, or was that just something that you started to discover about the banjo in particular?
I think it was, it was more related to music at the time, but actually it's funny that, I mean, now I'm starting to sort of expand the idea even further because it's applicable to so much. So, but at the time of writing it, no, I probably didn't see them as connected to any significant degree.
Right. So when you started writing that series for the Banjo newsletter, was there any part of you that thought, oh yeah, this might become a business someday?
So it was one of those things that I thought, I would love to do this at some point in time. I would love to take these ideas and actually turn them into a formal method that people could then take and use to learn. At the time, it was the articles themselves were, principles of learning that folks could use and apply. But I ultimately wanted to be able to bake that into a methodology. But it was at that point still pretty nebulous. I didn't have any kind of clear path in my head from getting to point A, from point A to point B. So I thought I would love to do this one day. I just couldn't see how at that point in time for a variety of reasons. But I think the idea has been in the back of my mind for a long time now.
What were some of the reasons that kept you from pursuing it right then?
The main thing would be time, right? To be able to sort of build something to that extent, it would require a lot of time and effort, which would mean, for me already working as a full-time physician, would mean time away from family and so forth to do it. And, the risk of, what if it doesn't, what if it doesn't, nothing comes of it and I've sunk all that time and energy on it. The other thing being, what format I would do it as. So, if I'm thinking of a traditional type of instruction, you may be thinking of, books and publications, and then you're talking about dealing with publishers. And so there are those hurdles to clear. And so, you have to get past the gatekeepers in those domains. So there were a lot of potential roadblocks if I wanted to do that as a side project. I figured the only way I would ever really be able to make that happen would be to go all in and maybe even take on investors or something like that as a way of doing it. And I just didn't feel like at that point in time I could take that kind of risk.
Right. So tell me about what made you decide to start oldtimejam.com.
All right, so oldtimejam.com, back in 2005, this is the last year of my residency, I was in Florida, and this is the time that I've gotten really into the banjo. I'm just starting to get into a particular style of banjo called clawhammer banjo, and I end up going to a banjo camp, because that's how cool I am, we go to the camp. I'm still still new to this particular style of playing, and so one of the features of the camp was that every night there'd be a jam. So this particular style of music, old time music, jamming is common to it. So there's this body of tunes that people know and play together. But I was kind of in the beginner to intermediate group that was jamming together, and so we had this room full of banjo players and maybe a guitarist, and trying to kind of figure out what tunes we knew that we could play. And since we were kind of all early on, we only each knew a few tunes and there was hardly any overlap. So we just kind of futzed around for a little bit and nothing much came of it. And so then I thought, man, it would have been nice if we could have just kind of had something we could have all gone to beforehand. Learn some common repertoire, and then we could have, at least gotten a little bit more out of this particular part of the camp experience with the jamming. So it was like it was that kind of planted the seed for that idea. But I didn't do anything with it for a little bit, and then a little bit later on, I started learning how to play the fiddle. And as I was doing that, I started making backup tracks for myself to play along to on the banjo, because fiddle and banjo is a kind of a classic combination of instruments. So, it was really fun. I enjoyed it, and I thought it'd be cool to make these available to other people. I bet other people would enjoy playing along with these tracks. And then I realized, if I, could build this, if I could create this as a player, some kind of music player that I'd put on a site that would just kind of roll through, And if I announced the key of the tune and that sort of thing beforehand, that I could almost mimic a jam experience. And so I thought I could put out the thing that I'd wanted those years before, you know, with that jam where people could get, practice jamming and learn maybe a common body of tunes before they got together. So as soon as I kind of thought of all those things at once, I said, I gotta build this thing. It's, you know, it'd be too useful. I want it. So I figured other people would as well. And so I basically took those tracks that I'd been making for myself and then, figured out sort of how to make the website, how to put a third party player onto it that would do what I wanted to it and so forth. And that's kind of how oldtimejam.com was first born.
What did it feel like to earn money from something other than your work as a physician?
Yeah. So, I initially, it was definitely eye opening, right? I didn't initially have an idea to monetize it. But after I launched it, there was a lot of interest. I just put one post up and it really took off after that. And then I started getting people who asked if they could like have a CD that so they wouldn't have to necessarily use it when they're online. And I started doing that. And then I realized that I don't want to be in the CD duplication business. So I started making the digital downloads instead, for the tracks, which ended up being way more popular anyways. Most people wanted those as opposed to CDs anyhow. And those started doing well. So, you know, that was eye-opening in the sense that, you know, here I just made something that, you know, I wanted to exist, and now I was able to generate a side income out of it, which then kind of got the wheels turning about, you know, other things that I might be able to do outside of medicine, and that kind of started the ball rolling to where I am now.
Right. So as you look back on those two experiences, the Your Brain on Banjo and then the oldtimejam.com, and kind of earning your first money online, do you think those were kind of the foundations for starting that business that's become what it has today?
Yeah, so that's definitely were two of the pivotal things that kind of set the stage for what I ended up doing with Brainjo. Your Brain on Banjo, it sort of had these principles that I'd put out there about learning and specifically learning music. And then I had this, you know, website that I'd built, for musicians. And I kind of was like, I knew I was tantalizingly close to kind of being able to realize the full vision of what I wanted to do. After launching the Old Time Jam site and after it did well. But I still kind of wasn't quite, you know, at a point where I knew what the next steps would be. But those two things were definitely, you know, pivotal, in terms of getting me to where I am now.
Right. So despite all that though, you kind of went through a little bit of a period where you had a lot of ideas, but you didn't necessarily execute on any one of them or take any one of them too seriously. What was it like to know that you had this yearning to have a project that combined some of these things, but not really see much progress or many results from it?
Very frustrating. So, I mean, exciting on one hand, but frustrating on the other hand. So I would, you know, I almost didn't want to have ideas because it was just like, well, how am I going to execute this? But I would still, I'd keep a file of once I had the Old Time Jam site and, you know, kind of realized what the potential was out there for, you know, what you can do online and how many people you can reach and you can reach people and, you know, in niche markets and so forth. And I knew what potential existed out there. And so I would have these ideas, but at the same time, you know, I couldn't see how any of them would be anything more than kind of side projects. And the just maintaining the Old Time Jam site was kind of took up enough of my time on the side that I couldn't figure out a way to get these other things done. So it was more of a cataloging my ideas, but for some other day, and trying to figure out a way to make it happen at some point. But it was frustrating not to be able to act on it further for a while.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah.
So eventually that started to change, though. So you found Smart Passive Income, and eventually that led you to Fizzle. So kind of tell me a story of how you ended up finding Pat's site and kind of how that started to change your perspective.
So like I said, a few years went by, had ideas for things in the online business sphere, not really knowing how I could, make it happen. And then driving back from Disney World, I think it was February or March of 2014, and just looking for something to listen to, and I thought I'll try these podcasts, and happened upon some like entrepreneurship podcasts, and eventually stumbled on Pat Flynn's podcast, and after listening for a bit, I kind of realized that the online business space had changed a little bit in a couple respects. One being that back when I was doing the Old Time Jam, it was still a little bit of the wild, wild west in that, a lot of people making money online were kind of doing black hat stuff and gaming the system and so forth. I didn't like that part of it. And that there weren't a lot of people to sort of model a full-fledged business after at that time, and there weren't tools that I knew about, at least, for doing so. But listening to Pat, I realized kind of things had changed. There were people building sort of legitimate good businesses online, and there was this emerging set of tools to help people do that. And so I got super excited. I realized, man, this may be exactly what I need. Maybe I can build a more substantial business online, and maybe execute some of these ideas because I could kind of see more clearly how I would do that. And so it was like that. I got all excited, told my wife about it, and I decided, I'm just going to start waking up 2 hours early every morning and try to make this happen. I don't know why I hadn't thought of that before, but
so how, when you're sharing that with your wife, what's her response to that?
Support, but, mixed with maybe, apprehension. On the one hand, that's cool, and she'd known too that I'd had all the stuff that I wanted to work on, and she'd seen that the other side had been successful, so she knew that there was some at least potential out there to kind of do more. So she was supportive on the one hand, but I was probably a little overly enthusiastic, so she probably realized that I, maybe needed to be tempered a little bit. But on the whole, she was supportive, and she was just like, yeah, she also has always been an early riser. I'm like, I'm going to start waking up with you. So that part of it she liked. So,
it's always iffy. You never know whether the spouse is always in kind of a vulnerable position.
Yes.
When they're paired up with an entrepreneur, because there's, yes, idea after idea after idea, and they never know which one is actually serious.
And sometimes I can feel like I can see ahead, a little better, and I can see, you have to trust me, this is where this can go.
Right.
But yes, it is a difficult position for them to be in.
So, you found Smart Passive Income, you found Fizzle, and you had this perspective that, really just an action plan, like, I'm going to wake up early every day and I'm going to get to work on this.
Right.
So you use that new inspiration to kind of take advantage of an opportunity to start teaching banjo through another newsletter. Mm-hmm. So tell me how you kind of ended up teaching through the Banjo Hangout newsletter next.
So I started, decided that I wanted to, I was going to wake up early, start trying to work on some of these ideas. Most of which were kind of things in the music space. And some of them were also related to the migraine stuff and ancestral health, but I the Banjo Hangout, which is like a big site for banjo players, said that you know, they were looking to put together a newsletter, and they were, you know, wanting some contributors for that, for our teaching articles and so forth. And I said, that's, you know, be a great opportunity. I didn't, you know, I had no real concept at the time of what I'd do with the opportunity, but I knew it was, it'd be something worth pursuing. So I pitched an idea at that point in time to create sort of an entry-level course for people to learn banjo, and particularly a style of banjo called clawhammer banjo that I play. And I said, I'll put this course together. It'll kind of be the entry-level course. It'll be called 8 Steps to Clawhammer Banjo. So it'll be a series of videos, 8 videos that'll be released every couple of weeks for anybody who's kind of new to it and just getting started out. And I figured it also give me an opportunity kind of to start realizing the Banjo concept of trying to incorporate these ideas about learning into the methodology for teaching music. The other thing I knew it would do would be to force me to learn how to make videos on a really, really compressed time scale, because it wasn't something that I had done much of beforehand. But I felt like it was a great opportunity. And so, you know, they said yes, and I took that on and spent a whirlwind several weeks or months putting all that together.
Yeah, what did you learn from that experience of kind of putting the time in to making these videos, which you didn't even know how to do to begin with, but
yeah,
and like teaching in a new way? What did you learn from that?
Probably the most helpful thing I learned from that was the mechanics of you know, just making and editing videos, right? So it was totally new to me, and if I had not made that commitment and not had the pressure of having to do that, you know, I probably would have spent months to years learning how to do the things that I had to learn how to do to make it happen. So it was a really great way to compress that learning in a short time frame, and also as a sort of a hedge against any perfectionist tendencies, because I had a deadline for each of these things to put out there. So I couldn't, you know, futz around with them until I felt like they were perfect. I just had to get them out there. And they were really, really well received. And so that was helpful, you know, because to put something out there that maybe is, you know, is not perfect, but that people are benefiting from, was a really important lesson, I think, that one I've continued to draw upon. And that whole you know, episode of having something that I had to produce, that I was committed to someone else to do, and was producing something that I really wanted to make, sort of that whole perfect storm of productivity, was something that I would kind of draw upon, I would continue to draw upon, as a way of making myself produce the content that I wanted to make.
Yeah, totally. Those are beautiful times of life when you go into one of those little periods of extreme productivity.
It really was. And like so much that, yeah, exactly. Extreme productivity and learning, you know, the two go together.
So, you know, you put together that series for the Banjo Hangout newsletter, and eventually you started something called the Clawhammer Tune of the Week. So tell me the story about how that came around.
So I put together that series, and that was all housed on YouTube. And I decided that that YouTube would be probably the best place for me to kind of grow this business, and that would be the best channel for doing so, because most people who are, you know, looking for materials on learning music are going to tend to start there. So I wanted to build up a channel, and I figured the best way to do that would be with some recurring content. So the course that I'd built would be sort of a one way for people to find out about the channel and about the materials that I had. But I also wanted some sort of recurring content feature as a way of building the channel, but also as a way of building, you know, potential customers. And so I created a series called The Tune of the Week, and basically there, I film a video of a tune being I play on the banjo, and I create the arrangement for it, and so folks can can sign up to be on the Tune of the Week list, and every week they'll get the video and the arrangement for that particular tune. So I started that back in summer, I think 2014, yeah, and I've continued to do that every week. And there's actually now a Tune of the Week and a Song of the Week. So the song being there's singing involved.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So, you know, you had these. Well, you had a recurring video series, and then you had the kind of course of videos,
mm-hmm.
and your audience started to grow in response to that.
Right.
What did that feel like to see people kind of responding to the teaching you were putting out there?
It was great. I mean, you know, it was, I think the most gratifying thing was the people responding to the course that I built, because, you know, it had incorporated some of the ideas that I'd had for a long time, and the fact that people were, you know, saying that it was working for them, and that they were able to learn things that they tried to learn in the past and were unsuccessful. So the fact that it was doing the things that I'd wanted to do was really exciting. So I made me want to kind of do more in that particular domain. And you know, building the list, you know, I realized that I had the seeds of a business there, you know, there was something there to it, and there's something I could do more with if I wanted to, which is really exciting.
Yeah. So tell me, when did you decide to take the kind of seeds you had planted and turn them into a real business?
So I initially had kind of had ideas for doing kind of one-off products, related to music. You know, maybe like courses and so forth, or music arrangement books and that sort of thing. But had always, you know, it still had the idea that I wanted to create this sort of fully, this comprehensive methodology for learning kind of beginner to advanced for music. But the problem with that still was that doing that would still require me to spend a whole lot of time and effort without anything in return to do it like I wanted to. And then, so I was working on some of the sort of one-off product pieces and so forth that I would present to the audience that I was building. But I also, in the back of my mind, I still, I didn't like the idea of doing it that way. I didn't like the idea of releasing something and then sort of going back to square one, releasing something else. Partly because I knew that if I ever wanted to do more with this, you know, and turn it into a more substantial business, that I would need a dependable and sort of stable month to month cash flow to ever say I could scale back, you know, with the other parts of my life. So I wanted to build something like that, and a membership site would be the most obvious way to do that with what I was doing. But it wasn't until it occurred to me that I could drip feed the membership and sort of build the course as I went along that I realized I could, you know, build the thing that I've been looking to build and kind of get paid along the way and not have to sort of risk everything and with all this time and effort with nothing to show for it. So once I realized that, that's when, and that was towards the end of 2014, I realized that I could create this site as a membership site and drip feed the content. And that way I could build the course as I went and sort of validate the concept early on. And even iterate, you know, what I was doing based on the feedback I was getting from my early members. So that's what I ended up doing and launched the first sort of course back in November of 2014.
So what did that feel like to have kind of clarity on a specific model, you know, a membership site and a method mm-hmm. for delivering the content and your kind of drip-fed model? Mm-hmm. And just having that focus on one particular project, how did that feel after so much time of kind of going here and there on different ideas and trying to see what would stick?
It was huge because, you know, it was still some degree, even though it was better than it had been previously because there were more tools for sort of doing this sort of thing, but it was still overwhelming to kind of figure out which direction to go. And I was kind of working on multiple projects simultaneously. And then once I figured out that I could just sort of put my all my eggs in this one basket, it was focusing on many levels. You know, number one, you know, where I could now put all my time and energy. And then number two, in terms of just sort of designing a business around that, right? Trying to create the whole system from, you know, finding your customers to conversion and so forth. And having that all in one space really made things a whole lot easier. That was another moment. I was as excited when I realized that as I was when I listened to the Pat Flynn podcasts on that ride home.
Yeah.
Because I just knew that was it, and so you know, it felt like a caged animal from that point forward.
So, you know, do you remember the day you kind of hit publish or launched the course in November 2014?
Yep, I sure do.
What did that feel like?
That was one of the best feelings ever. I still remember. I mean, you know, I built the course. I built the website for it. I put together the first few months of material to have for the first signups, and then, you know, put it out to the list that I'd built. And, you know, you just wait and you just don't know. And I mean, this was, you know, in some respects, an idea that had been germinating for, you know, a couple of decades almost. And sort of kind of put that out there and then just wait and see if it's going to be, you know, what kind of reception it's going to be was, you know, nerve-wracking, exciting, and every, you know, all sorts of emotions. But getting that first sale, that first validation that somebody's interested in this idea, you know, it's hard to describe how amazing that felt. And don't tell anybody, but it was probably better than when I graduated from medical school.
So. Yeah, we'll keep that one between you.
Keep that
one
to yourself. But I mean, I don't know. There's just something so gratifying about taking an idea that's just in your head, you know, and putting it out there and, you know, seeing people resonate with it. It's just something unique about that that's pretty awesome.
So at the time, did you like realize that you had almost unintentionally built an entire marketing system, you know, in that you had all this free content out there and
right.
you had been producing content for other sites and newsletters and
yeah.
so you had a great marketing mechanism. Did
right.
you know that at the time?
I did and I didn't. I mean, I was doing it in part because I thought maybe one day, you know, I could do something with this, right? But I didn't, I probably didn't fully appreciate it. And the nice thing about it at that point in time was that because I had kind of, you know, I was already out there, I already had a system for getting people interested in what I had, I could then really just focus in on building the product and the full membership. And I start, you know, the system for getting people to it was already existed, you know. But yeah, I didn't, you know, it was in, you know, in retrospect, it probably looks, you know, more deliberate than it was. But there was some sense along the way that by doing these things, it was at least setting myself up for doing something more with it one day, because I thought I really would like to do something more with it one day. So I thank myself for many years ago of deciding to do something that didn't have any real, clear path towards how it would ever, you know, benefit me in any like financial way, but, you know, just for doing those things, mainly just because I was interested in them and wanted to put those ideas out there.
Right. So, what was it like to continue delivering on that content and kind of build it up over time and follow that model that you had hypothesized on from the beginning?
Yeah, that was great. I mean, that was, you know, I was finally getting to do the thing that I wanted to do, and there were people who were paying for it and saying they wanted it. So, that was fantastic. And that's really what I, you know, focused in on, other than I still had to sort of maintain these other things that I'd had going and was committed to. But being able to work on that and work on sort of this thing that that I've been building up to it for a long time was phenomenal. And I mean, I was, you know, one of the things that's kind of strange now is that, you know, I work on this a lot, and people will say, you know, are you working? And it, I never know how to answer that, because it's like, I'm working, yes, but I'm also like doing this thing that I really want to be doing. And I finally have the freedom and the ability to do it. So, yeah, it's a really good feeling to be able to be able to build it now.
So have you had any of your customers share stories of learning the banjo thanks to your teaching?
Yeah, quite a few. So, and in fact, one of the things I've been doing lately is to try to make a more concerted effort to collect those stories. I really like getting them. But yeah, getting you know, the people who were part of it, you know, range in all ages and backgrounds. So people in their teen years, and I've got people in their late 80s who have, you know, just taken up the banjo at that age and learning. So, you know, that's amazing to me, and it, because it's kind of what I wanted. I wanted to give people a system, and a system that both showed them the way to do something they thought maybe would be not possible for them, but to give them a system to show them how to do that, and also to give them the confidence that they could do it. And the fact that there are people out there doing that is just, you know, it's phenomenal. It's really, really rewarding. And yeah, I hear from a lot of folks who say, you know, they're able to do things they didn't think that was possible, or things they'd struggled with before and are now able to do. So it's really cool.
Is there any one of those stories that really sticks out to you about kind of that it kind of embodies why you continue to do the work?
I think I probably would, there are a few stories, but the main one for me, folks who were, I've had several people who were in their like late 70s, early 80s, said they'd always wanted to learn, you know, an instrument, and learn to play banjo, and decided to take it up. And use the course, and we're able to, you know, at that point, you know, no huge goals, but just being able to play music on there and entertain, you know, a grandkid or something like that. So people who've written in to say that they can do that sort of thing and wouldn't have thought it would be possible. Those for me are kind of the best stories.
Yeah. Yeah. I would see why. What's that feel like? To know that you're kind of impacting people at whatever stage of life they're in, whether it's, you know, late in life in that kind of situation or early in life and they're just getting going. What's it feel like to know that you've made this thing and, you know, initially maybe it was you wanted to build a business, but now there's mm-hmm. kind of real people getting impacted.
Yeah. I mean, it's right. It's incredible. And the, I mean, that's one of the things too, that's, it's easy when you're doing something that's online to forget that there at the other end, there are all these humans, you know, with all their own stories. And when you get to hear the individual stories from people who are doing, you know, who are using your materials or using your thing, and it's affecting their life in some positive way. That's really when it, you know, changes and when it takes on a whole new meaning. And you know, even if it's just one person in that regard, it's still incredible. And it's sort of an amazing thing to be able to even do that in this day and age. But so yeah, it's really cool. And I think that one of the things that I've, you know, that I really wanted to do with the whole business to begin with was to help people sort of, you know, do things that they hadn't previously thought possible. And so hearing people, you know, who are able to do that now is really awesome.
So here we are in March 2016. What's up in the business now? Where do things stand?
So the business is doing well. There's you know, it's kind of growing on a consistent basis. So trying to figure out, you know, what next? So I've got sort of the, you know, the things that I have to do to maintain the business, and then, you know, kind of deciding where to grow from here. One of the things that I'm working on is expanding to other instruments and other styles of playing. So I've actually partnered with another musician and I'm working on a course for fiddle also working on a course for another style of banjo. So that's kind of the immediate future, is to expand this concept into other instruments and other styles of learning, and at the same time, you know, sort of further refine the business. There are a lot of things that I can see that I, you know, can do to grow it further and to kind of further refine what I've done. It's just a matter of you know, the time to do it. And that's another thing I'm trying to do, is to create more time in my life to really focus in on building this particular business.
If you wanted to, could you go full time on your business today?
I could, yeah. So I've reached a point, thankfully, amazingly, that my time spent doing this is actually the return on that investment is better than my return on doctoring. So I do have the ability to kind of go full time on this and foresee doing that. Which is really exciting and incredible.
That's awesome. So when you think back to that guy graduating from medical school in 2001, do you think he would have ever expected to be running a business teaching banjo today?
No. No, I don't think he could have seen that at all. But, you know, the world has changed a whole lot since then. So that's, you know, he wouldn't have been surprised that he was doing something different. But this in particular, no, I would never have predicted.
How do you think the Josh today is different from the Josh that got his board certification? Or the Josh that had just received his board certification,
yeah,
I guess.
So I think the Josh today has realized that has realized that that there are more pathways in this life than we realize, and that kind of once you start to look at everything, I think Chase likes to quote that Steve Jobs quote about you know, once you look at life and realize that you know, everything that we call life was designed by people, you know, no smarter than you or something like that. That whole idea probably wasn't in my head at all back at that time, but it's certainly something I'm very aware of now, and so much more intentional about what I do and the decisions I make, and realizing that really anything is possible. That, you know, that you don't have to do things exactly like the script says, or exactly like you know, how other people who are in the same sphere of life that you are doing things, and then oftentimes the best things come from not doing those things. So that's probably the biggest difference. Also, realizing that money is really just a tool to buy freedom and to give you the time to do the things that you really want to do. And it should never be the end goal. The goal is to be able to have a life that you want, and the freedom to do the things that you want.
So now that you could be making a full-time living from your business today, you know, for many people, that's kind of the pinnacle of what they can imagine for being an aspiring entrepreneur. Do you feel like you've kind of made it?
No. I mean, in one sense, yes. In one sense, I'm just, you know, extremely grateful to be in this position, mainly because, you know, I now feel like I have the ability to spend my days doing the things that I love to do the most. So in that sense, yeah. And there's really, and one of the things, I guess, that's different between me now and me then was I realized there is no making it, right? There's, you know, it's all the life is the process, and there is no, you know, gold at the end of the rainbow. So it's really about how you're deciding to spend your days. And so from that sense, you know, I feel I'm in a very good place, and I'm in the place that I want to be. But that's not to say there are not more things I want to do. I mean, the thing that I want to do most is to spend my days, you know, learning new things and creating new things and creating things that, that ideally make other people's lives better. So I want to continue to do that. And so I wouldn't be satisfied as if I stopped doing that now. But on the other hand, I feel immensely grateful to be where I'm at, and to be able to have this kind of life.
So if, you know, if there's an aspiring entrepreneur listening to this that kind of struggles with, maybe they have an important and prestigious career like being a doctor or something similar, mm-hmm. but maybe she also has an inner drive to build a business on the side someday, what kind of advice would you have for her?
So first piece of advice would be just be very honest with yourself. If the reasons why you're doing what you're doing, which, you know, if you're in a prestigious position or a position that took a lot of time and effort to get to, one of the things that's really, really hard for, you know, a physician or any other professional is the whole sunk cost fallacy. So it, you know, there's so much time, effort, money that goes into getting an advanced degree that it's really hard after you've gotten to that point to ever do anything else. And so that's probably why you don't see too many people, you know, in those domains, you know, changing course. Even if they might be happier or more fulfilled doing so. One thing is that I've realized doing all this is it's kind of absurd that we even expect people to do the same thing for decades on end, right? And not everybody does that, but the people who end up doing it are folks in these kinds of areas. And I think the whole, you know, sunk cost fallacy plays a part of that. So the first thing is just making sure that's not the thing that's driving you to continue on and not pursue the other stuff that you want to pursue, making sure that you're doing it, you're in it for all the right reasons. And then the other thing is if there is something else that you want to, you know, that you're interested in, figure out how you can test that, what's the sort of the minimum way you can put some effort and energy into it and find out if it's something, that's viable and that could turn into something more, that's part of what I've been doing is try to figure out, you know, what out there could I make that would be of interest to other people and try not to put too much into it before I go full on with it.
Right. So, you know, if you could go back and you could do the whole medical school thing again and you could get board certified and be a physician and study mm-hmm. neurology and all the things you've done in mm-hmm. order to get to today where you are with Brain Joe.
Right.
Do you think you'd do it the same way again?
Yeah, that's really hard. If it's all the same time and same technology and everything, I think so. If it's, you know, if you're talking about doing the same thing in 2016, I don't think so. I don't think that, that I probably would have gone down the same road if it were this day and age, you know, when I was back in college and deciding where I was going from there. But back then, I think so. And I have, you know, one of the things that I always remind myself of is that, you know, it was developing that expertise, you know, was a real asset for me and really helped to shape what I was able to do down the road. So I'm thankful to have had that past. Like I said before, I don't like to think of all the hours I spent studying for trivial tests and what I could have done if I'd, you know, diverted those energies somewhere else. But on the whole, I think, you know, I probably would have done things pretty similar to what I did.
Yep. And despite all that, you took your own advice. You know, you have ignored the sunk cost fallacy and you've gone out and done these extra things despite all those things, which is awesome.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's not easy. Yeah.
Well, cool, Josh. That's all I have.
All right.
You feel like we missed anything?
I don't think so. Yeah, you've covered it pretty good.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, good. You get a couple minutes of your afternoon back.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I appreciate you doing this.
Yeah, definitely. I'm excited for it. What I'll do is I was hoping I would get all these edited and ready for production before I left for my wedding next month or this month rather, but don't think it's going to happen. So what will likely happen is I'll get you over the final edit of the episode sometime in May.
Okay.
And let you give that a listen and just make sure it has, you know, good integrity on the story and everything. And then we'll push it live.
Awesome.
Cool, man. Well, thanks so much. Hope you enjoy the beach.
All right. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Yep.
And good luck with the wedding.
Thanks, sir.
All right. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
Bye.